now that we've loosened up a bit, I'm gonna chase down an audio setting real quick.
All right. So that's while you do that, I am going to say hello to Stephen Cook, who we've decided today, just today, is our favorite guest.
Nice.
Yeah, we were having a contest between Matthew and I, and we both voted, and we decided it was you.
That's good, because I got a text message from an old girlfriend not long ago today who said that my wife must be a saint. So balancing it out. I'm your guy's favorite. Clearly, my old girlfriend does not feel the same way.
Yeah, don't talk to either of my ex-wives. So, well, thanks. Thanks for coming on. Just to, oh boy, things are bad.
Yeah.
I want to give my own personal context here because.
Oh, please.
So I got shit canned, laid off, right, from Vice because they don't want to be in the news business anymore. It's all right. It's the way the business is. So backing up even farther, we had a gentleman named John Spencer on to talk about Israel several weeks ago, and I would say I came away displeased is maybe the wrong word, but like unsettled from the conversation. Mm. We can get into that maybe a little bit later, but then I got laid off, and then when that happens, there's a lot of paperwork and a lot of union meetings, and I kind of shut my brain down to everything that was going on outside of my own personal bubble. So does my understand, like, I've been getting kind of glimpses of what's going on over the past 2 weeks. Can one of you deliver me, it all seems very bad, but can I get the headline version of what's been happening?
Yeah, I'm happy to do it. The humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip has grown quite dire. About a quarter of the population is now food insecure. And the UN is estimating that by May, there could very well be famine in the Gaza Strip. The United States has given the bottlenecks in aid coming over from Egypt and the Israeli restrictions. The administration has ordered U.S. Central Command to conduct airdrops of food. This came after an Israeli effort to distribute aid through local, what they're calling local Gazans, turned quite bad, and 100 people were killed in a stampede and firing from the IDF, Hamas. It's very, very unclear. There's an investigation. So things are really, 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 really terrible in the Gaza Strip. In the meantime, the Israelis would very much like to undertake military operations in Rafah, the city that's right on the border with Egypt. It's a city that has normally about 100,000 people in it, but about 1.4 million. I'm sorry, normally has 300,000 people in it, but now has about 1.2 million people crammed into it who have sought refuge from other parts of Gaza. And the Israelis want to conduct military operations there because there are four Hamas battalions located there. And they also believe that the Hamas leadership is in tunnels beneath there. But the administration has said, unless you come up with a credible plan for evacuating civilians or giving them refuge, this is like a no-go for us. And so there's really at odds. In the meantime, the president has begun speaking about a two-state solution, speaking more forcefully about humanitarian aid. The Israeli government has turned around and offered their own day-after plans, which do not include a two-state solution, the way in which the administration is talking about the day after and beyond doesn't seem to meet at any point with the Israeli position, which is permanent security control over the Gaza Strip. So it's pretty terrible. There's tension. A member of the Israeli war cabinet, Benny Gantz, who also happens to be the primary rival to the prime minister, was in town in Washington and met with senior members of the Biden administration, though not the president. And he came away, quote unquote, surprised by the criticism that he was facing. Now, it's very unclear whether he really was surprised or he's playing politics. If he was surprised, it reinforces the idea that the Israelis are living in a bubble, although I can't imagine that the Israeli embassy is not reporting back to Jerusalem that things are growing tense with the administration. So that's where things stand right now. And of course, we saw the State of the Union last night. Actually, I saw the first third of it. I fell asleep, and then my wife poked me, and I saw the last third of it, which happened to include the Gaza-Israel discussion. And it is true that the president has sharpened his rhetoric with regard to Israel and you know, spoke plainly about 30,000 Palestinians killed. You go back to October, he said you can't trust the Palestinian numbers. So there really has been a shift. The question is this more than a rhetorical shift in recognition of the uncommitted votes in Michigan and Minnesota? Or is there genuinely a shift underway in U.S. policy? My sense is that we wouldn't really see a shift in U.S. policy until the administration starts fiddling with military aid. And that has not happened. So this seems like a rhetorical shift, at least at the moment. The big news coming out of yesterday's State of the Union address is that the president announced plans for the United States military to build a temporary floating pier off of the Gazan coast in order to flow aid into Gaza. It's not a panacea, of course, but it certainly holds out the promise for more aid getting to people who desperately need it. So that's not really a nutshell of what's happened in the last 2 weeks, but you get it.
This answers one of my questions, which was I'd heard that the news broke middle of yesterday, Thursday the 7th, that they were talking about this pier. But the comment was also that there would be no boots on the ground. And I wondered, how do you accomplish this? How do you build that kind of infrastructure? So you're saying the idea is to build a floating pier and then push aid to the shore?
Right. So it's actually a plan that I first heard way back in October, you know, from the Cypriots and others, that the best way to provide assistance to Gazans is by sea. And clearly the administration has taken this up. And so I think the idea is that the United States would build this pier. You would have American military personnel on this pier coordinating with whomever is tasked with moving the aid from this pier onto the shores of Gaza. Whether that means that, you know, you have U.S. servicemen, you know, service personnel aboard whatever vessels are bringing the aid to the Gaza shore, but without ever getting off of these vessels or not. I mean, I think these details really have to be worked out. I suspect that this pier floating port, whatever it would be protected by the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force, that we're not just going to build this thing and then go away. I also get the sense this will be a multinational effort. Like I said, this is an idea that I first heard from the Cypriot government a number of months ago. The good news about this is that the Israelis are all for it. Sure, why not? It would relieve them of responsibility for something that's proving extremely difficult for them to do, which is providing humanitarian aid to Gazans. I think that where the problem will be is who gets to vet the aid. You know, the bottlenecks on the Egypt border are the trucks, before they're even offloaded and put onto other trucks that can be in the Gaza Strip, have to go through a series of inspections. And if there are things on the truck that the Israelis don't like, the truck gets pulled out. It's not like you unload the things they don't like and the truck proceeds. So is this going to be the responsibility of the United States to vet the aid coming through this floating port? Or are there going to be Israelis there with Americans? These are details that yet to be worked out. But I do think if those details can be worked out and they're not too cumbersome and they're not too complicated, which inevitably they will be, but it does, providing assistance by sea is a lot better than airdrops. And we obviously by land would be best, but we see these bottlenecks and they're, you know, and it's just an inadequate amount of assistance that are going to people.
I actually heard a horrible report that with dropping supplies, that one, at least in one case, parachute didn't deploy and people on the ground were actually killed by the supplies being dropped.
You know, it's inefficient. You can't do a lot and it's dangerous, especially if there aren't people on the ground to coordinate it. You know, so these things drop. In this case, the parachute didn't deploy. It dropped on people. But when they do, you know, people are desperate And one of the worst things in the world to see are these, you know, pictures of people who are like desperate for food. People can get killed, get hurt in the process of trying to get food.
I just want to say for my own personal experience, and also because of things I've said on the show, it's attitudes of American Jews, I think, are also shifting to a certain extent. People who were full on whatever happens in Gaza stays in Gaza, and, you know, anything it takes to get rid of Hamas, actually hearing people now want ceasefires for humanitarian reasons who before would never have considered it even a month ago. I feel differently about it now, too. Do you see, are we just catching up to the rest of the world? Or, I mean, what do you see?
Are you asking me as a, you know, CFR senior fellow in the Middle East, or as a little Jewish kid from Long Island?
Well, you know, as a little Jewish kid from Manhattan, I mean, you know, whatever you like, but, I'm just sort of wondering what, you know, what you think.
I mean, I wouldn't want to paint an extraordinarily diverse community in a broad brush. I think that there was obviously, like in Israel, a rally around the flag, and, you know, the attacks on October 7th really, you know, had a profound impact on American Jews as well, given the nature of these attacks, the numbers of people killed, the way they were conducted, I think really shook people to the core. I do think there was a certain amount of kind of willful, not understanding, not willing to understand what was to come, which was that the Israelis believing that they're in an existential struggle, and the fact that Hamas hides among civilians, that large numbers of civilians were going to be killed, and there was going to be this tremendous amount of suffering. I think what you're hitting on, Jason, is the fact that people were unable to separate these issues, that yes, Hamas's attacks were diabolical, and yes, they do want to kill Jews and they want to destroy Israel, and that there is a genocidal aspect to what they're doing when they talk about the longest occupation. They're not talking about liberating Gaza and the West Bank. They're talking about liberating all of Palestine, and the implication of that is to kill the 7 million Jews who are Israelis. So, but you do have to compartmentalize, and there are hundreds of thousands, 1.5 to 2 million Palestinians in Gaza who are innocent and who are caught in this crossfire and desperately suffering. I mean, we now have actually more than anecdotal evidence that Gazans are not only blaming Israel for their suffering, but they're blaming Hamas for bringing this on them. I think you would have to be, and I think that's one of the things that people have commented on. I think that's one of the things that you're responding to, is that have Israelis and world Jewry that support Israel's operations in the Gaza Strip, have they lost their humanity in the process of this effort to root out those who would do Jews great harm? And I think that people are coming around to the idea that you can hold two thoughts at one time, that Hamas is evil, but that Palestinian babies should not be held accountable for Hamas's evil deeds.
Jason, what was the shift moment for you?
It hasn't actually been all that quick. I think that, sort of deferring to relatives in Israel to start off with, they were the ones who were attacked. And to get out ahead and call for a ceasefire or any other, you know, prescription for the situation there seemed inappropriate. I mean, that, you know, people there had a different view of things. And but it's when you start hearing about starvation, honestly, more than anything else.
And you start seeing it too, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the pictures have been absolutely harrowing.
There's, you know, you can make terrible mistakes and kill people who shouldn't be killed with weapons, especially if you're dropping bombs. All these, you know, the whole concept of collateral damage, which I think is such an incredible phrase, but I mean, we went along with it in Iraq. We went along with it, you know, I mean, every country in the world that's ever fought a war is responsible for, quote, collateral damage, unquote. But starvation is preventable. You know, it's not a byproduct of war in the modern age. And I think that's
a great point.
Really, yeah, that's kind of what changed my mind.
Well, I could hear it. I feel like when we had a conversation with John Spencer, Stephen Cook, a few weeks ago, who is this, and the kind of the headline of the conversation was Israel is fighting a very moral war, and they're doing it. They're really trying to minimize civilian casualties. And Jason, mm-hmm. I could hear like in your voice and in the way that you were asking some of the questions about him that you maybe didn't quite buy everything that he was talking about. The one that stuck out in my mind specifically was he's like, you know, before they attack a building and they go in for Hamas, they call everybody in the building and tell them to leave. And you softly pointed out, well, like, cell service in Gaza is famously pretty terrible. How functional is that kind of solution? And I'm just wondering if your thoughts had been shifting maybe earlier than you thought than just the starvation.
I think that it's, for me, it's an impossible situation. I also was reacting against a lot of the college students and the people who were calling for, from the river to the sea, and they couldn't actually find either on a map. It is, you know, I mean, and all of a sudden everyone's wearing a keffiyeh and you start to, I mean, I was feeling under a lot of pressure as a Jew, frankly, and I'm not particularly, first of all, I mean, I'm a genuine atheist. I mean, forget about not particularly religious, but I mean, I'm an actual, but, you know, still have a synagogue that we're associated with and all that kind of fun stuff. And you see the police cars and the community and everyone's crying, and put that together with the guy who was the professor who was exhilarated by what Hamas did, and you're setting up a position where it's not built for sympathy. I think that it's an incredible situation. I mean, Stephen, we should get back to you, but I do know that children are not raised to love Israel, and Israeli children are not raised to love Palestinians. There have been some incredible cases of the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency and what they've allowed to be taught or have taught in schools.
Right.
So I don't know that I guess I'm humble enough to say I don't really see a solution. I think that people do genuinely hate each other. And that the two-state solution, I can see the problems with it. I think it's probably the best possible option, but I can see the problem setting up another country right next to yours that has its own military and everything else that, and everybody hates everybody. Eh.
And it doesn't seem like Israel will ever let that happen.
Well, particularly now, I mean, the polling in Israel demonstrates that too, you know, I think in Washington, people are too focused on the personality of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I call this the other BDS, BB derangement syndrome. You know, everybody calls him BB. Because what I've had to point out over and over again is that 2/3 of the Israeli public in polling demonstrates that, you know, they are opposed to a two-state solution. This is a hardening of views after October 7th, that Benny Gantz, the member of the war cabinet, who is looked at as a more moderate than Netanyahu, actually ran to the right of Netanyahu on Gaza and has been saying that the Israelis need to go into Rafah and destroy Hamas. I mean, he's a, you know, decorated military officer. But I want to get back to something that Jason said. And I think what you're articulating is a lot of things that I think a lot of people have been feeling with the rhetoric coming from universities, cultural institutions, Jews feeling shut out, allies leaving them, Matisyahu being, you know, chased out of venues where he's playing. Matisyahu is someone who has, you know, stood for peace. Yes, he believes in the legitimacy of the state of Israel, but has, you know, been clear in his views about coexistence and so on and so forth, and him being, you know, labeled a racist and so on and so forth. These things are very, very unsettling. I live in a community. I'm like you. I haven't declared my atheism, but I am a kind of 3 day a year synagogue Jew. I'm more of a, you know, bagels, lox, cream cheese, Sunday New York Times Jew than anything else. And but I live in a community where if you go out to the main road, there are three different synagogues within a quarter of a mile of each other of different flavors. And on Saturdays, we have a fairly significant police presence, and the rest of the week we still have police as well as private security. So it's a very, very unsettling time. Franklin Foer wrote in the Atlantic magazine, "Is the golden age of American Jews over?" So I think that I think, you know, it's easy to be hard on the community when it's, you know, seems to have not been sympathetic to the consequences of Hamas's actions on October 7th and what's happened in the Gaza Strip. But Jews, I think, quite rightly feel under threat in a place that they never felt under threat before. People not wanting to send their children to certain colleges, universities. I have a child who's going to college for the first time in August. And there was lots of discussions about, oh, would you send your daughter to Columbia or Penn or something like that? I mean, I don't want to get into it. But it's, I think a lot of people have these incredibly complicated and fearful feelings about what's happening. As far as the two-state solution goes, again, I think you're quite right. The idea of this that the administration is now pushing it is, strikes me as odd. And I wonder whether it's more driven politically by polls of undecideds than it is based on President Biden's clear-eyed calculation of what's possible. Even under much, much better circumstances, no Israeli government could satisfy even the minimum demands for peace that the Palestinians had. And vice versa, no Palestinian leadership could satisfy even Israel's minimum demands for peace. Those were under much better circumstances. Oh, and by the way, those demands are mirror images of each other.
What can you articulate them?
Yeah, sure. So I was just about to. So thanks. We're clearly on the same wavelength. Same wavelength here. Israel. Jerusalem is the united eternal capital of the Jewish people. Palestinians, we must have at least part of Jerusalem as our capital. those are the minimum. Palestinians, we must have a contiguous, fully sovereign state within the June 4, 1967 boundaries, where this in and of itself is only 21% of historic Palestine. So we must have this. Israel is like, oh, no, but we have to keep all these settlements and we'll withdraw a little bit here, a little bit there, but we're definitely not going back to the 67 lines. And you're definitely not going to be fully sovereign. Maybe the extent of withdrawals or so on and so forth is negotiable, but the basis is not. These are mutually exclusive positions. Third, the Palestinians have to have some redress to Palestinian refugees from 1948 and their descendants. Israel is like, we're not ever going to allow any refugees back into Israel proper. How do you manage these three things? And then especially now. I'll give you a kind of a real or world example of it. I have a friend from graduate school who's Israeli, grew up here in the United States, left the United States, has become an Israeli. And he lives just across the way. He lives within Israel proper, but he lives just across the way from an Arab village. I mean, from his yard, you can see this Arab village. It's quite close. I think people who've never been there don't have a real appreciation for the distances. In any event, I've been in almost constant contact with him and his family since October 7th. And he said, if you go by the polling, the people across the way from me, you know, huge numbers of them are supporters of Hamas. This is not a recipe for, you know, good neighborliness and a propitious moment for American diplomacy. Now, I think the diplomats would say, well, you can't stop trying, and what is the other alternative? I think those are good arguments, but we should at least be prepared for that much better than half chance that we're not going to get a two-state solution, and that there may end up being some kind of ugly version of the status quo that settles in once military operations are over.
What is that status quo? Like, what is Israel's plan after the conflict is over?
Yeah, I think that they're going to go back to sealing off the Gaza Strip. But instead of staying out of the Gaza Strip, they will avail themselves the right to go in and conduct raids against remnants of Hamas or whatever comes in to replace it, in the same way that they've been doing that in the West Bank and Palestinian cities like Jenin, in particular Jenin, but others. We saw that actually in the spring and of 2023 and summer of 2023, where the Israel Defense Forces were much, much more active in the West Bank and going after Hamas operatives than, and they had pulled people away from the Gaza border, believing that Gaza would be quiet. I think that's a template. I think they'll likely try to ring Gaza with Iron Dome batteries. I mean, but when the prime minister and his closest advisor, Ron Dermer, the former ambassador here, who is now the Minister of Strategic Affairs, I'm not sure what that means. But nevertheless, when they speak about a enduring Israeli security control over the Gaza Strip. And someone like me hears that and says, oh, so basically what you're talking about is occupation. They say, no, occupation. Because when they say occupation, they think settlements. But there's also like a significant number of people to the right. You know, you've heard about this kind of religious right coalition partners. They're talking about resettling the Gaza Strip. Now, this is important. This is not necessarily a fringe. That part of the right, which, by the way, also includes less extreme elements, have a better argument about security now than they did when, for example, Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005. They were the ones who said, Avigdor Lieberman, who leads this party called Yisrael Beiteinu, who's not part of the coalition and who had a terrible falling out with Netanyahu in 2018. In 2005, he and others said, well, withdrawal from the Gaza Strip is just going to invite attacks and attacks inside Israel. And so now that October 7th has happened, they have a much more potent and compelling political argument for people on the right, which is that when Israel was in the Gaza Strip, there was more security than when Israel was out of the Gaza Strip. That's the political configuration. So how is it that people are like seriously considering that the two-state solution is a possibility?
How does the rest of the world react, though, when officially combat operations are over, if that's even a thing? I just think about all of the energy that's being ginned up in the Palestinian cause. And I understand that, you know, most of the support is a mile wide and, you know, an inch deep. But I just kind of wonder if, as far as the rest of the world goes, can we actually go back to that status quo where Israel's back in the bosom of nations as so far as it ever was?
Right.
And we, you know, have our chat services all run by Israelis and, you know, and the various other things that you know, startup nation that Bibi like to talk about.
I think some of the Palestinians don't believe that there's been a paradigm shift, right? And that there won't be, that when, you know, the guns fall silent, we'll go back to some version of the way it was before. I mean, they obviously don't wish that was the case, but I think Palestinians don't put a lot of stock in the kind of rhetorical energy people have put into this issue. I would point out that no country has broken diplomatic relations with Israel. There have been recalls of ambassadors, a number in Latin America. The Bahrainis didn't send their ambassador back to Tel Aviv, but they didn't break relations. None of the Abraham Accords countries, Egypt, Jordan, none of them. There may be tension. There may not be ambassadors there. The Jordanian ambassador is not in Tel Aviv. But no one has actually broken relations with Israel over this. So there, you know, it's possible to rend our clothing over something that's not necessarily happening. I suspect that there will be lots of discussion about reconstruction and donation of aid. I'll point out that, you know, the wealthy Arab states have a long history of you know, committing to large amounts of aid and then never really actually delivering it. But it is going to be, it is the major difference here is that the Israelis have, from their perspective, been fighting an existential struggle. And as a result, they've done considerable damage to the Gaza Strip. Your previous guest had talked about, you know, the Israelis being very careful. It's clear that they do some of these things, but it's also clear that they have loosened the rules of engagement. That because they believe they're fighting an existential struggle, that they believe that they've had to do certain things that they wouldn't have otherwise done because they need to destroy Hamas, and also try to turn the Palestinian population against Hamas. You cannot discount the fact that this has been a real free fire zone for the IDF, where they have loosened the rules of engagement, where they have taken down, you know, what, 60% of the buildings in northern Gaza in order to break Palestinian society away from Hamas. Like I said before, there's a fair amount of evidence that that's begun to happen. That's different from the West Bank, where there's, you know, Hamas's stock as resistance has gone up. Still, it's horrifying what's happened. And I can't imagine that something comes to an end and then Gaza is going to be left in these ruins. So something is going to happen. I haven't yet seen the plan or anybody step up. Part of it is the Saudis, the Emiratis, and others make the case, hey, look, we're not going to be the ATM for reconstruction. That's just going to get destroyed in 2 years and 3 years and 4 years, again, in another round of fighting between Israel and Hamas. Something has to change. They have said there has to be a credible two-state solution. That's hard to get to. The Israelis' argument is, well, if you don't want to have that happen, let's get rid of Hamas. Now, I can imagine that privately, these governments are totally on board with that. But they're also, I mean, Gaza's terrible situation. I mean, the words, very, very hard to describe words. Like, as you said yourself, Jason, you know, starvation, and when you see it and it's happening, is really hard to get one's head around, especially when this was not something that had ever been an issue, even, you know, with Palestinians under occupation, that people had starved.
Even, well,
I'm sorry, I use a no, Friday afternoon. Well, at least you can go have a drink afterwards.
Yeah, good point.
Even if Hamas is destroyed, say,
whatever that means.
Whatever that means.
Sorry, I just want to throw that in there.
No, absolutely. Yeah, it's a good point. Refrain. Yeah. It seems as if the energy that gave rise to it will still be there.
Whoa. Right.
And will perhaps be worse in a post-conflict world, in a post-conflict Gaza, right?
Yeah, I think that is the major issue before the Israelis, which they have no real answer. Let's just set that aside for a second. Let me just say, you know, it's actually starting to chafe me how many times people I hear, you know, we're in these meetings in Washington, and so it's like, well, you can't destroy an idea. You can't destroy him. Yes, that's true. But I think you can render a group incapable of being an existential threat to your security. And I think that's what the Israelis are after, you know. Destroying Hamas, this is political language that I think the Israeli government on October 7th, October 8th has to use. You know, you may not like Netanyahu, you may distrust him, you may think he's a terrible human being, et cetera, but he has politics also. And so I think a lot of this is political language. And I think that just like the United States after the September 11th attacks on New York and Washington couldn't contemplate anything other than destroying Al-Qaeda, I think the Israeli public was demanding that that Hamas be destroyed. And so then an Israeli government wouldn't be able to do anything other than that, whether it was led by Netanyahu or, you know, someone else. I think that the concern that this kind of violence begets a Hamas 2.0 or something else is a very, very real one. I think the Israelis have tried to square that circle by saying, look, we're going to have permanent security control over Gaza in perpetuity. recognizing that this is something that's likely to happen, but that because they'll have the whole thing bottled up, that it will won't be a threat to them. I don't know whether that's true or not. I also don't know whether we can take any comfort in that assertion that they would have security control over Gaza, because these are not sentiments that are confined to the Gaza Strip, right? Extremist groups in the Middle East have used the conflict, used Israel's existence as a mechanism for mobilization. So, and that's another thing. It's another, you know, people tend to think the two-state solution is like this panacea, right? Oh, there'll be peace, but for the extremists, this is surrender. The land has been sacralized. So even a solution doesn't end the extremist phenomenon. But getting back to the issue at hand is, yes, there is a real possibility. There was a possibility before this. And it seems almost inevitable after so many people have been killed that extremists will continue to thrive in this kind of environment.
All right, Angry Planet listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this. All right, Angry Planet listeners, we are back on with Stephen Cook.
I have a really cold, calculating question. And I've wondered now for a while if the only reason why Israel still exists, I mean, you know, I was brought up to think of it as being in existence in a sea of its enemies, which, you know, considering some of the wars and stuff like that, you could see it that way, right? Does Israel just exist because it has nuclear weapons? Is that the only reason why that no one is actually just cleaning things out from the river to the sea? I mean, is that why there is this?
I mean, I think the logic behind Israel's security doctrine is, you know, the kind of overwhelming technological superiority of the IDF keeps the peace, right? And the United States has helped ensure that through what's called the Qualitative Military Edge, QME in Washington speak, which really was only was enshrined in law in 2008, but was something that since the October 1973 war, the U.S. has sort of pursued this policy of QME. At the same time, I think that the unrelenting hostility of the states around it is a little bit more nuanced than that. We know the Jordanians had relations with the Israelis. Obviously, Egypt and Israel have been at peace for, you know, more than 40 years, and there were feelers even before Sadat's trip to Jerusalem. There's never been, or rarely, I guess, before the Syrian uprising and civil war, there were never incursions across the ceasefire line on the Golan Heights. And that's not because the Assad regime liked the Israelis, but the Israelis were keeping the peace by dint of their overwhelming superiority. The Gulf states have had under the table relations with the Israelis. I give you a funny story. In 2022, I ran into former Israeli defense minister and health minister in Dubai. And I had met him once before, and we were in the same room, and I said, "Oh, it's, you know, it's nice to meet you again," and so on and so forth. I said, we're making chit chat, and I said, is this your first trip to Dubai? And he looked at me and like I was insane, and he said, this is my 33rd trip to Dubai. And people forget that Qatar was the first country to open an Israeli trade office in a capital outside Egypt and Jordan that had made peace. So, you know, Netanyahu a number of years ago popped up on Omani television because he was in Muscat. So, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, his this Vision 2030 for Saudi Arabia, it demands kind of regional integration. And so the Saudis have, you know, been exploring, and through all of this fighting have continued to express an interest in normalization of relations with Israel. So I think it's a combination of things. I think the thing that, you know, I heard from people in the Gulf is that one of the things that's making life more difficult is that, you know, for a generation, this was not, probably less than a generation, but for a long period of time, this issue was not front and center And so the process of normalization and preparing populations for normalization would have been easier. But now we have this war that people are seeing every day in a number of different mediums, and it's making it harder.
So it's really real politic has been at work for decades.
Yeah. And I you know, I neglected to mention the Iran factor, you know, that all of these countries perceive Iran as a threat and it drives them together.
Mm-hmm. Why does Iran, by the way, have this special place in its dark little heart for Israel?
It wasn't always the case, actually. You know, under the Shah, Israel and Iran had open relations. The Iranians supplied Israel with a lot of oil during that period. They had a common enemy in the Arabs. The Iranian revolutionaries, the clerics, were hostile to Israel. And Israel is also a means through which they can play in the politics of the region and advance their own interests, put their neighbors on the defensive in an effort to advance their influence and their power in the region. Otherwise, they would be isolated. So they have this axis of resistance that they've developed over these years, pardon me, that helps them sow chaos throughout the region, which makes them this incredibly important factor.
It seems like it's less the nuclear weapons, Jason, and more that the authoritarian regimes in the region
kind of like the Israelis.
They find common cause
with them.
There's common cause, and you always need something for the fanatics within your ranks to strive to defeat that is not you, so they don't look inside, right?
I'm not sure the Emiratis are directing fanatics in their midst outward. I think, you know, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, the Moroccans have seen economic advantage to the relationship with Israel. That certainly the Saudis emphasize that very much. And then there's the security cooperation. Of course, after October 7th, I have to say, you know, they have to wonder whether they were signed up with the, you know, whether the image of the Israelis matched the reality. I would say probably Israelis have, you know, extraordinary capabilities. They were asleep at the switch on October 7th. They didn't listen to the young women who were spotters on the border of Gaza who kept saying, something big is coming. But that is the subject for an internal investigation in Israel.
I think we should talk. If you have any other questions about Israel, that'd be great. But I also want to make sure that before we let Stephen go, that we talk about, actually, he's got a new book coming out soon. We were talking before we started recording a little bit about it and the troubles with getting any book to produce and some of the fun that goes into it. But I just want to make sure that we get a chance to talk about the end of ambition, which is not a bad title.
Here are the galleys. I have them in electronic form, but I'm so old school, I printed them out because I was like, I got to touch something because I haven't seen it yet. Here it is. It'll be out on June 3rd. It is a look at, the subtitle is, it's called The End of Ambition. And the subtitle is America's Past, Present, and Future in the Middle East. And what the question it asks is, you know, we were once very successful in the Middle East by our own, you know, setting our own goals. We wasn't always pretty. There were costs to it, but what we set out to do, we did. How did it get so bad? And now that it's gotten so bad and we've confronted, you know, decades of failures in the region, what is it that we have to do to be more constructive? And I go through this history and then offer some prescriptions for what the United States should be doing in the Middle East. But overall, what I'm suggesting is that in the early 1990s, we took on this ambitious, transformative goal for the Middle East, one of the regions of the world that seemed most in need of transformation. And because there was no Soviet Union any longer, and because we had defeated Saddam Hussein in, you know, days, essentially, we believed that we had the power to make good things happen in the region, not understanding the limits of our power, and that our power, and I don't want to give too much away. I mean, I'd like people to buy it, but that our power is best leveraged when we're trying to prevent bad things from happening rather than trying to make good things happen. And that tends to run against the grain of, you know, American ethos. You know, we do good in the world. We saved the world from fascism and communism, but our return on investment from trying to make good things happen and transform the Middle East is almost zero. But when we wanted to prevent bad things from happening, we were able to achieve the things we want. Now, maybe you can argue about what those things were, but we were able to achieve them.
I was just going to also say that I noticed in particular the book's cover, which people can't see. Maybe we could put a picture up when we post it, but it's this really, really cool desert with a highway going through it that's covered by desert, like we'd left a long time ago.
When we were thinking about titles, I mean, this was a working title that became the title, but I was like, oh, if my publisher, which is Oxford University Press, comes back to me and says, can you give us some other alternative titles that we can mull? That's happened before. I was going to say, we're on the road to nowhere. I might have a problem with the talking heads, but I thought that would be kind of cool. But yeah, it's the people have reacted very strongly to the cover, which is actually good because people see covers and like, oh, maybe that's a good book to read. I'll buy it. Or I'll assign it to my class of 500 undergrads or something like that.
Well, it's very right. It's this symbol of empire since the age of the Romans, a road being swallowed by the desert, right? Just
yeah, I actually want to meet the designer who did it and give that person a big hug because I think it really does capture what the book is about. You know, we had we're paved with good intentions, and now we're swamped.
So, I mean, I don't want you to give too much away, but can you tell me about the 90s and how we got good at preventing bad things from happening?
Well, it wasn't the 90s when we were good at preventing bad things from happening. It was essentially a post-World War II up until the 1990s. I talk about February 26, 1991 and December 26, 1991 being those moments where we shifted from prevention to transformation. And what happened on February 26, 1991 is Saddam waved the white flag. And on December 26, 1991, the hammer and sickle, the flag of the Soviet Union, came down over the Kremlin for the last time, and the Russian flag went up. And up until that point, we had very kind of modest goals in the Middle East. We tried to prevent any country, a coalition of countries, from interfering in the free flow of energy resources out of the region. And we tried to prevent, particularly beginning in the 1970s, any country, a coalition of countries, from threatening Israeli security. And that was done through American predominance. After those two dates in 1991, we said, hey, wouldn't it be great if this part of the world, which in this sort of updated neo-colonialist way we looked at as kind of retrograde, wouldn't it be better? And this is a quote. Bill Clinton said, let's bring these countries into the 21st century. And for the Clinton administration, it was transformation through the peace process, that if there was a settlement of the Arab-Israeli conflict, the rationale for the big national security states of the region would wither away, and there would be this democratic transformation, which was, you can sort of admire the sequencing, the elegance of the sequencing, but it did not actually grasp the reason for these big national security states, which were really domestic, not had anything to do with Israel. And then the Bush administration sort of turned that on its head and said, no. You have to have democracy before you have peace. It's only after you have this reform. And so we went, and then 9/11, I mean, this all kind of happened in the crucible of the post 9/11 environment. And so we went about transforming the region, which would bring peace and prosperity to everybody. And these things were this different sides of the same coin, which was this ambitious effort to remake other people's societies without having a really good grasp, I think, of what made them tick.
That sounds very American.
Well, and I, like I said, I think there are arguments in the book that are going to cut against the grain of what people say. Like, you know, I say to people sometimes, you know, maybe there isn't a resolution to the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. And like, that's not my hope, but maybe there, maybe there isn't. There's a certain, you know, I did write it. I conceived it and wrote it, a big chunk of it during COVID. And obviously, and then, you know, political instability in the United States and looking at the previous 20 years of, there's a certainly Stephen in darkness aspect to this book. So despite my generally sunny disposition, there was, yes, Stephen in darkness kind of thing about.
Is there then a kind of liberation in letting go of ambition?
I think so. I think we would be much better off. And actually, we being constructive and looking at our policy more in preventive terms, we may actually have a fighting chance of seeing good things happen. It just won't be necessarily because of us. Sometimes we actually need to get out of the way of things. You know, the Abraham Accords, which people celebrate, which I think they genuinely should do. I think, you know, a lot of the human rights activists, I think they have some arguments about authoritarian systems and so on and so forth. But I think that the Abraham Accords have a fighting chance of like bringing people together and so on and so forth and changing dynamics among countries in the region. We didn't do that. You know, they give President Trump.
Well, Jared Kushner did it, apparently.
Well, my understanding of what happened was he sort of like we came in to kind of seal the deal with goodies, but we weren't the ones who were doing this. I mean, the Israelis and Emiratis were driving at this for 5 years before. The Bahrainis and the Israelis were driving at this for 5 years before. There's been long kind of under the table relations between Morocco and Israel. And we gave the Moroccans, we sweetened the pot for the Moroccans by saying, oh, that Western Sahara conflict that no one knows and cares about, we recognize your sovereignty in the Western Sahara. That was like, the Moroccans were like, great, okay. We'll bring our relations with Israel out of the closet kind of thing.
I remember reading about that particular war many, 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 many years ago. It's in the Western Sahara, and it's like the worst place in the world. Truly, no one should want it, but yet.
I know. Isn't it amazing?
Yes.
Well, you know, when you live there, it probably seems pretty important to you.
Yeah, but why do you care if you're not, if you're American? Anyway, it doesn't
matter. Whole other podcast.
Well, the fact that we, if you looked at Americans, even knowledgeable Americans, and you said Western Sahara, and they would look at you like you, so, yes, so they would have no idea what you were talking about. Demonstrates that we didn't care enough about it. So it was an easy giveaway to the Moroccans.
Yeah, very good.
Right, to incentivize them on the Israeli front.
Yeah. Right, it's like spending other people's money. It's the easiest thing in the world.
Right, exactly.
If I can bring us back around just here at the very end before we let you go. What are the levers of power that America can pull here?
In the current conflict in Gaza?
Yes.
This is a important question that I think people have been debating or kind of dancing around is what power does the United States have? The Israelis seem to be doing things in defiance of the Biden administration. Hamas, we can't get our arms around this. I think it's unfortunate. It's another kind of reality that I think sometimes people don't want to, is that we have a bunch of countries in the region that we call our partners that aren't always our partners, and that they can calculate, and they calculate their interests differently from the United States. Now, in the Israeli case in particular, as I said before, they define this struggle in existential terms. So they're going to be somewhat impervious to outside counsel when they think that they're fighting for their life, even from your best friend. I was having this conversation earlier today, and I said, the president can declare certain things unacceptable and say the Israelis must do stuff, but he's going to have to back it up with action if he really wants to get their attention. And it seems to me that the only thing left for them to do is to, as I said earlier, fiddle with military aid. I'm not sure he's going to do that. I don't see Joe Biden doing that, just given his worldview, given that it's an election year. But I think that's, and the other problem with that is that you can threaten that, and then if you carry it out, but it doesn't, because the Israelis define this in existential terms, it doesn't fundamentally alter their approach, you look weak, and then you have no more bullets in the chamber. So it's something to be used very, very carefully. I think under more normal circumstances, we may have an ability to talk the Israelis off the ledge, but not in this conflict. I saw the October 7th footage.
Did you go? You've seen the film that they were kind of.
There is a film, but there's also those kind of raw footage. It's about an hour or so of raw footage. I'm not justifying anything that the Israelis have done since, but this is truly among the most horrifying things that I have ever seen.
Well,
the kind of thing that startles you awake at night, kind of thing. Weeks after. I mean, I don't mean to be overly dramatic. I mean, this is actually my experience with it. I felt it was a professional responsibility to see it. And I don't regret that I saw it, but it is deeply, deeply disturbing.
Well, thank you, Stephen Cook.
Sorry.
No, that's not right. I like ending the show on notes like that personally.
Yeah. No, I'm just,
because I think that that's a good thing to highlight, especially at the end. I think people ignore, that Hamas has avowedly said that they want the destruction of the state of Israel. That's part of the charter. And that October 7th happened.
Right.
It was as horrifying and as brutal an act as we've seen in a long time, right?
Right. And it's hard to put words to it. It's not just it's the images, the personal nature of this, the things that Hamas said and did while these people were doing this to other human beings. And some of it really, you know, push Israeli buttons here. They were killing people within sovereign Israel, but they were referring to Israelis as Jews, dogs, and mustautanin, settlers. This is not in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. This is in sovereign Israel and things like that. So this is deeply presses on every kind of neuroses that Israelis have. And Jews too. And going back to what Jason was talking about earlier, in any event, I'll leave it there. I mean, we could do a whole episode where we can plumb, you know, the depths of depravity. I'm happy to come back and do it if necessary. But I'd like to talk about something nice. Nice. Well, I can't think of anything though.
Just like as a note here at the end, I think that it is possible and important to hold both. Remember both things at the same time. To hold both thoughts in your head.
Yes, I have counseled people that as well. Yes, absolutely.
You know, and I would say that is one of the greater ambitions of the show, is to force people to confront that kind of thing. Right. I wouldn't even call it a dichotomy, because they're not.
Which is a great position,
right?
Great thing about the show.
Thank you.
Anyway, it was a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Yeah,
it's absolutely really wonderful. Thank you.
Always interesting and fun. And hopefully we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you got a book coming out, so you know.
We'll definitely be doing it again soon. Right. We're gonna Thanks. Need copies of that book, by the way.
Yeah, you
get us on the list.
Perfect. Okay, you're on the list.
Good. That'd be very good. All right. Thank you again.
Thanks. Cheers. Cheers, all guys. Right,
be well.
Bye. That's all for now, Angry Planet listeners. As always, Angry Planet is me, Matthew Goldjason Fields, and Kevin O'Dell. It's created by myself and Jason Fields. If you like us, please go to angryplanet.substack.com or angryplanetpod.com. Kick us those $9. It helps us keep the show going. Probably going to be some written stuff there shortly. Looking forward to getting some of that going next week. We're going to have a conversation about nukes coming up. I'm going to track somebody down to talk about Kissinger. I'm going to do it. Fallout bonus is coming. It's in the works. We've got a Discord. If you want to get on there and see all the Dune 2 memes that are being shared, you got to sign up at angryplanet.substack.com or angryplanetpod.com. As you've heard, other episodes, you even get to send in your own questions. So, angryplanetpod or angryplanet.substack.com. We will be back next week with another conversation about conflict on an angry planet. Stay safe until then.